What you have before you on this page is a chart originally created by Bishop Calistos Ware for his courses on the Theology of the Trinity at Oxford University, and below it, the texts from Davis' History of the Ecumenical Councils, Chapter 3, his description of the 4th century development of Trinitarian doctrine and the Arian controversy, culminating in the Council of Constantinople in 381. The chart is linked to portions of Davis' text. If you click on the names of several of the councils, Sirmium, for example, and the early Synod of Constantinople in 359-360, which should not be confused with the Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, the Second Ecumenical Council. If you click on those synods, as well as the Synod of Alexandria, the Macristic Creed, the Dated Creed, and so forth, you will find that you will be taken to the portions of Davis' text which are relevant for those portions of the chart. And I'd invite you to look at Davis' text at your leisure. It's a very helpful description. However, it is a chronological discussion of this period, which is necessary in order to appreciate how the positions develop. But this chart is an attempt to describe the positions ahead of time so that one can have in one's mind a sense of these different positions as they then develop chronologically, having looked first at the chart and being aware of the different extremes, one can more easily appreciate the chronological development in the 4th century and the unique and astonishing fact that towards the middle of the century and really until the resolution of the Arian crisis at the Council of Constantinople, the majority of the Christian Roman Empire was ruled by Arian bishops. There was a profoundly Arian influence over the whole of the Christian world, which then receded largely due to the implacable and constant influence of Saint Athanasius of Alexandria and his successor, Basil of Caesarea. Let's look at the chart. I have highlighted in blue and on the right and with a kind of a bluish-gray background the Arian position and noted, as Bishop Calistos in this chart originally intended one to see, that in the Arian position there are both moderate and extreme positions. Arius himself represents an extreme position, an emphasis on the dissimilarity between the Father and the Son, a dissimilarity in which the notion of homoousios, or the same essence, is completely rejected in favor of the notion of the Father and the Son being so dissimilar that one can speak of the Son as a creature. Now, within the Arian fold, as it were, there are both moderate and extreme positions. The extreme position being Arius, as you can see, and then his later successors, the so-called Neo-Arians, or the Anomoians, who stressed, and the term simply means, the dissimilarity between Father and Son. The two names associated with this are Aetius and Eunomius, whose work culminated in the so-called, described by later Nicene theologians, the blasphemous Synod of Sirmium, at which the dissimilarity between Father and Son was particularly highlighted. And in many ways, it seemed at that time, and of course there was imperial support for this in the successors of Constantine, it seemed as if the Nicene Creed, the notion of homoousios, was being set aside definitively. Now, that extreme position, that anomoion position, is contrasted with the somewhat more moderate position of someone like Eusebius of Caesarea and his followers, who emphasize not the anomoion, but the homoion. The anomoion, or extreme Arians, would say there is no similarity between Father and Son. The Eunomius, for example, would say that he knows the nature of God because the Father is unbegotten and the Son is begotten. Therefore, they are dissimilar. However, Eusebius of Caesarea, although an Arian, although rejecting the homoousios, the unity of essence between Father and Son, would emphasize the homoion position, that there is a similarity. The Father and the Son are similar. Some of them would say even a great similarity between Father and Son, but not equality, not unity, not a unity of essence. As we'll see, the centrist position is articulated by such individuals as Basil of Ankara and Eustathius of Sebaste. Basil of Ankara, not to be confused with Basil of Caesarea, whom he influenced. He was, in some senses, Basil of Caesarea's mentor. But Basil of Ankara and Eustathius articulate a centrist position which has come to be known as homoiousion, or semi-Arian. These individuals would be willing to speak about the essence, the nature of God, and to say that Christ and the Father have a great similarity of essence, that their essence is similar in almost everything. And so they're pushing closer to the Nicene position of the unity of essence, of ousia, of substance between Father and Son. If we look at the left-hand side of the chart, in which there are the names and the synods are primarily in red, and the background's a much brighter, a yellowish color, you will see that there is both the moderate Nicene position, particularly exemplified by Athanasius, later by Basil of Caesarea, who is St. Athanasius' successor. Athanasius does his best at the Synod of Alexandria in 362, and if you click on that name and drop down to Davis's text, you can see more details about that synod. Athanasius does his best to reconcile as many of the centrist Arians as he can, trying to help them discover a way in which their compromised position can lead them to an assertion of the Nicene position, and even acknowledging and accepting them in communion if they can agree that they are really talking about much the same thing. Part of the difficulty, one of the great difficulties of this period, is that until the Council of Constantinople in 381, there is no clear word used, there is no clear term that can be used, that is used consistently to describe the different persons of Father and Son. The notion of hypostasis, which is emphasized at the Council of 381, which is particularly emphasized by Basil of Caesarea. It's his great contribution theologically. Even Athanasius doesn't quite come to the point of using the term hypostasis differently from the term ousia. There was a great need for this way of talking about the distinction between Father and Son, but in a way that didn't call into question their unity of essence. That would ultimately be Basil's great contribution, as I just said, but during his lifetime, Athanasius tried to point out that in the absence of a specific term, in many cases, the homoiousions really meant almost the same thing, or the same thing, but they were trying to safeguard what they felt was the necessity of distinguishing between Father and Son in the face of what they saw as the extreme position of the Nicene party, particularly exemplified by Athanasius' friend, Marcellus of Ankara. Marcellus believed in the unity of Father and Son so much so that he pushed it to a point of heresy, that in a sense he almost doesn't really distinguish between Father and Son. He has a notion of the Trinity that is rather temporal or economic, that is, it depends on the needs, as it were, of creation. It's almost as if the Son is a kind of an extrusion, a sort of a systole, an outpouring in time of God into creation, which then, as it were, resorbs back into the unity of God. Marcellus is so concerned to emphasize the unity of Father and Son that he really isn't able to speak about the distinction between them. And the homoiousions are concerned about the deficits of that position and the need to find a way of speaking about the distinction between Father and Son. Ultimately, it will be, as you see, and he's a kind of a crossover figure, the great contribution of Basil of Caesarea to provide the language of ousia as essence, which is the same, the one essence, mia ousia in Greek, of Father and Son. They are of the same substance, as the Latin tradition will say, but they are different persons. They have different hypostases, which is the term that Basil will particularly emphasize using to describe the distinction between Father and Son. In the Latin, this will come to be understood as persona, whereas earlier, and especially in the writings of Athanasius, there wasn't a clear distinction between ousia and hypostasis. So, in many ways, this chart gives us a kind of a progression through. It's chronologically from top to bottom, but it gives us a sense of the broad spectrum of opinion and reminds us of the fact that there were extremists on both sides of the issue, and helps us understand how the Council of Constantinople represented the final resolution of this controversy. And it's important, again, to bear in mind that this resolution was pushed by imperial authority. The example of Athanasius, his tremendous fidelity under persecution, his willingness to continue pushing for his position even despite multiple experiences of exile, was a powerful witness to the Church. But in fact, most of the bishops of most of the important sees were forced to condemn Athanasius. He was a lone voice in the middle and latter part of the 4th century until the rise of the Emperor Theodosius, who was a committed Nicene and who was able to force and impose the Nicene solution on the Church at the Council of Constantinople, as we shall see. One of his instruments in the early phases of this enforcement was Gregory of Nazianzen, who, at first living in Constantinople, preached his great theological orations and provided a popular appreciation of the theology that Basil of Caesarea had provided. Basil had died before the Council of Constantinople met. Gregory Nazianzen made this available, and he was briefly Archbishop of Constantinople, but he eventually resigned that position because of controversy, about which we will speak later. And we turn now, of course, to the texts of the Council of Constantinople itself.